Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It's 1:10 p.m. that is Pacific Standard Time. Today is January 14th, and Tesla's acceleration continued in here today. It was up another $13. Obviously, this is a rather spectacular advance when we look at it even over a logarithmic scale chart. We can clearly see that it is accelerating, having not far off tripled since the middle of last year. The only time that's even remotely comparable to the size of the move we're seeing right now was the initial breakout in 2013, and even that was larger. That was a truly incredible advance, as Tesla then monopolized the capture of carbon credits, particularly in California, when the Karma Car company went bust. The name of the company is escaping me for the moment. Part of the reason why the share is accelerating right now is because Tesla has moved on to Europe and they're capturing carbon credits over there too. And the fact that they are getting Fiat Chrysler to build their battery and car manufacturing plant in Germany is rather ironic, to say the least. But I think part of the reason why the share is rallying so fast is because of shorts being burned. Even as a result, even following this incredible short covering rally, we can see that the short interest as a percentage of float is still around 18%. So that's significantly below where it was back in perhaps about 6 months ago. It was a lot higher than that, but now we're starting to see that the short interest is being reduced. Of course, Tesla and Google are both pursuing autonomous vehicles. Google is, pursuing what would be considered to be a conservative way of doing it. They've just signed a deal with a labor providing service so that they will have drivers in their autonomous vehicles for the foreseeable future, at least the next couple of years. And they are trying to build out the app-based call for autonomous vehicles. The drivers don't really have to do much, but they do have to be behind the car as Tesla, as Waymo rolls out its service, particularly in the Bay Area, but also it was started off in Phoenix. Well, I was in Phoenix last year. There was absolutely no evidence of the autonomous vehicles, and everyone I talked to was pretty much ignorant of the fact. So there was an extraordinary amount of hype around the sector as well. But the other way that the alternative to the way that Tesla is approaching this problem is the way that that Waymo is approaching the problem is how Tesla is doing it. They're introducing progressively more autonomous features into their software and allowing the owners of their cars to become test subjects. Now, this is what might be considered to be you need to break a few eggs to make an omelet approach to developing technology. So far, they've been able to avoid the threat of litigation, because it is people are supposed to be taking responsibility for their own cars. But one thing that Tesla is enabling its cars to do is to drive above the speed limit, and that does represent a number of interesting phenomena. Of course, any of us who've got cruise control on our vehicles can set it to drive above the speed limit, and Tesla would argue that that's what they're doing. But there are increasing reports of cars driving down the highway at 80 and 90 miles an hour, where the passenger is asleep. So obviously there is clear ability for the car to perform autonomously in certain circumstances, particularly on highways. And now the bigger question is, as we continue to see Google and Tesla doing rather well and extending the breakouts from their respective ranges. How long is this likely to persist for? We don't have any evidence just yet that this really quite impressive advance has ended. What we are starting to see, however, is some of the more beaten down speculative shares are doing better. Uber, for example, has broken its sequence of lower rally highs. This is a company that for whom autonomy represents an existential threat. So the fact that it is rallying here is, I think, more a representation of appetite for risk rather than long-term investment potential. Also, the fact that Beyond Meat, which is one of the most highly valued of any of the recent IPOs, has also been reflective of this continued demand for risky assets. Visa in here today has completed its acquisition of Plaid, and Plaid provides a lot of the back end for services like PayPal or Venmo or Square. And PayPal is bouncing from the region of the trend mean, and it had a very clear upside weekly key reversal from around the psychological $100 level in October. Square, which is which was founded by Jack Dorsey, the original CEO of Twitter, is also steadying from the lower side of its range. So certainly there is some interest in fintech, but it's the move that we've seen in Bitcoin of late, I think, really does stand out. It is now back above its trend mean, and it has broken the consistency of the trend from the peak in June. It had been encountering resistance at $1,000 increments on a monthly basis. That ended in December. In fact, it ended in November. And now it is pushing up and through the 8,000 level and testing the 9,000 level. Well, it hasn't quite yet broken the sequence of lower rally highs, but the consistency of the decline has certainly been broken. And that suggests that at least we're back in a parity between supply and demand. If it can continue to hold the breakout from this little range that formed between November and early January, then I think we can conclude that we're back in a demand-dominated environment. This is another instrument, though, that had an upside key reversal. This time it was right before Christmas. So I think that is one of the more interesting developments in the fintech sector. Now, the big question from the perspective of appetite for risk and this risk-on environment is the trajectory of the Fed's balance sheet. They've added almost $400 billion in 4 months. Back in September, there was a Bank of America report where they were estimating that they would add $400 billion over the space of a year. Well, so far they've got the figure right, but the timing was much faster than that. The Federal Reserve obviously knows what kind of risk they've taken on by supporting the repo market. They're looking at other ways of supplying liquidity and potentially moving beyond the banks, and I can't help but think that their potential plan to supply money directly to the hedge funds is like inviting the fox into the henhouse. We can't blame the fox if he's going to eat the hens, because if hedge funds are given direct access to Fed funds, well, we can anticipate that leverage is going to increase. And obviously, there's moral hazard there from the perspective of the Federal Reserve, but I think that isn't, when people are commenting on that, it's to ignore the fact that they've been holding interest rates low for a long time. They've been massively expanding the size of their balance sheet, and then the persistence of those low interest rates as well. All of those things have encouraged speculation. Now, when we think about the continued advance we're seeing on Wall Street And the rather wide overextension relative to the trend mean, well, it is really being driven by liquidity. We haven't had the same kind of earnings growth in this particular phase of the move that we had in the early phases of this decade, more than decade-long bull market. The clear change we've had at the Federal Reserve, where they are now willing to predict trouble in the economy, or at least react very early to signs of trouble. Well, that alone is something that is of clear change, because the previous suite of policies was to react to clear evidence of trouble. They were not willing to make prognostications about when a bubble might be about to pop. Well, that willingness to take early action almost ensures that we're going to have a bubble. And there was news just before the close that the repo facility was exactly the same as last time. It's been held this week at over 35 billion. The reality is that, having now engaged in supporting the repo market, the Federal Reserve is in a catch-22 scenario. They are going to be heavily penalized if they try to reduce the size of the balance sheet again. And that is something that is going to have to be dealt with eventually. But in the meantime, the market is breaking on the upside. What's also, I think, rather relevant in here is the willingness of China to reinvigorate its steel sector. It's been trying to clamp down on the shadow banking sector for 3 years. It does look increasingly likely that that process is now ended, and that does open the door to additional support. The ASX 300 Resources Index in Australia has broken out to a new recovery high. It is now at the highest level we've seen since late 2011, and it's been trending reasonably consistently higher for, well, nearly 4 years now. I think that's a rather important development. Obviously, iron ore and coal exports in Australia aren't particularly popular right now with the number of fires. One thing that Australia and California seem to share is the uptick in fires over the course of the last couple of years. They've also shared the reluctance to perform controlled burns over the course of the last couple of decades. That's definitely been the case in California. And California also had the mountain pine beetle infestation, which killed off a very large number of trees and created even more tinder. But there was a Royal Commission in Australia that came up with a number of recommendations about controlled burns and management of forestry that, if they had been implemented, would have greatly reduced the threat of uncontrollable wildfires. And of course, they were ignored, in just exactly the same way they were ignored in California. And that is, I think, part and parcel of the emotionality that we have in terms of the climate argument. There is obviously there are obviously challenges, but what we need to have is a much more, I think, mature conversation about what is appropriate, what needs to be done, and what are reasonable actions that can be taken to protect the environment, protect lives, protect wildlife, and also protect the planet. And all of these factors should be open for discussion, and yet we seem to be uniquely unable to do so. The ASX 200, though, has broken back above its trend mean, or excuse me, it's bounced from the region of the trend mean and broken out to new highs. Excuse me. The Australian dollar is right in the region of the trend mean. It has now broken its sequence of lower rally highs. It hasn't quite yet been able to sustain a move above 70 cents, but I think there is the clear potential that it will be able to do that. Australia probably doesn't want to have the strongest currency, but there is nobody or there is no country that is printing with the same abandon as the USA. The dollar index has been trending downwards since the beginning of October. That pretty much coincides with the expansion of the Fed's balance sheet. As long as the Fed continues to expand the balance sheet, I think it is reasonable to conclude that the dollar will trend downwards. Now, when we think about what's going on in Europe, excuse me, I'm after developing a case of the hiccups. The euro is right in the region of its trend mean. It's held the sequence of higher reaction lows since October. There's been a clear downward bias to trading since the beginning of 2018. And if it can sustain a move above the trend mean, then we're back in a demand-dominated environment. The rationale for deserting the continued outperformance of Wall Street and plowing into either the Eurozone or the UK, Japan, or emerging markets is really very clearly tied to the dollar. International investors like to have capital market, currency market, and yield in their favor. Right now in the USA, they have the continued resilience of the dollar, at least, although it has been weakening over the last few months. They have the continued resilience of the stock market, and they have a competitive yield relative to zero interest rates in Europe and Japan. So therefore, it's going to have to be the dollar is that breaks in order to really ignite a recovery in Europe and in the emerging markets in Japan. When we look at, for example, the European region generally, including the UK, it has broken back above the 400 level, and it's up about 5% since the Christmas holiday. There is clear potential that it is completing the 20-year range. If we were to get some additional steadying by the euro, at least that it were to stop trending downwards, that would lend some support from the perspective of an international investor's perspective. When we then think about the UK, it's a very similar story with the FTSE 250 steady in here today. There is still quite a wide overextension relative to the trend mean, but at least it is still a very modest consolidation that we're getting in here. And the moving average continues to turn and to play catch up. The longer we see a range form, the more likely it is we're going to see the unwinding of this overbought condition. Germany has reported a rather significant budget surplus, and that does open up the potential for Germany to engage in additional fiscal supports. They needn't breach the 2% deficit limit. If they were simply to just spend their surplus, that would provide a rather significant stimulus for the domestic economy, which is highly reliant on China. Well, China is starting to turn, and that should help to support the outlook for the domestic manufacturing sector. So, Europe's recovery is as much tied to the potential for the dollar to weaken as it is for China to continue to recover. And the renminbi was in additional stronger territory in here today. Now, when we then think about what are the domestic Chinese stocks doing, the CSI 300 has so far been able to hold the breakout from the range in 2019. It was in negative territory in here today, and there is a short-term overbought condition. But as long as it is finding support in the region of the trend mean, I think we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Then in Japan, the Nikkei is now back above the 24,000 level, having had that very clear upward dynamic yesterday. It is back testing resistance over the course of the last few years, and it does have the potential to break on the upside. Of course, Japan is highly leveraged also to the global economy. The second section index, which is a clear lead indicator for Japan, is also back testing its peak. When we then think about the major technology exporters, Taiwan continues to extend its breakout. We need to go back at least 30 years for the peak in Taiwanese stocks, all the way back in 1989, and we're on the cusp now of breaking on the upside. The South Korean market has broken its downtrend, and it is being led by Samsung Electronics. Well, of course, both of these countries are highly influenced by international demand. The fact that they are breaking out and breaking downtrends is very supportive of the global reflation trade. It's also one of the animating factors behind the continued outperformance of the semiconductors index, which still is pushing on the upside. We are inevitably going to get a period of mean reversion at some stage, but it would need to pull back by at least 100 points to even begin to suggest that that is unfolding. Now, the gold price was in negative territory in here today, but it was well off the lows. This continues to look like a consolidation, and as long as it is holding the $1,550 region, that is perhaps the best case scenario, that it popped on the upside and is now finding support in the region of the previous peaks is truly a testament to continued outsized demand for precious metals. The long and the short of it is that gold tends to respond when there are negative real interest rates. The Federal Reserve and Bank of England have both stated that they're willing to tolerate the economy running hot, and they are pretty much pursuing a loose monetary policy. They're trying to create inflation, and in the process, they are devaluing the purchasing power of their respective fiat currencies. And that is one of the primary reasons why gold remains well bid, and it continues to look like a medium-term bull market environment. Palladium prices have been accelerating on the upside, and they were in additional positive territory in here today, up another $45. And there have been consecutive days on the upside. The sequence of higher reaction lows, particularly since May of last year, remains very much intact. We now have more of a step sequence uptrend with a range above another, and what that suggests is that the $1,980 area should represent an area of support on the next significant pullback, and that is assuming that the trend remains consistent. Platinum prices remain trading below the $1,000 area, but they are back testing it, and they haven't had the same amount of volatility that was characterized by the last test of the $1,000 area. This finding support in the region of 950 is, I think, rather encouraging. I sold out of my silver position last week, and it was down another 20 cents in here today, but so far the reaction has been relatively modest, and with both gold and platinum still reasonably steady, there is the potential that silver may not pull back on this occasion like it did on the last few occasions when it's had these big downward dynamics. We've got an ample example of that in September twice, and then again in November. I think we can continue to give the benefit of the doubt to the precious metals as long as they're trading above their respective trend means, and that this period of consolidation that's been underway now for the last 4 or 5 months is all that's all it is. It's just a period of consolidation within an otherwise clear bullish environment. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.